welcome Sean Fogarty from Hackney Socialist Workers Party. He is speaking on Trump's attack on Syria, why we say no to imperialist attacks. He'll speak for 25 minutes and then we'll take questions and discussions.
Well, thanks, Ellie, and thanks to everybody to invite me back to Chesterfield. It's nice to see all these familiar faces. This is a really important issue for us, but it's funny, you might have been surprised to discover that Trump launched this attack on Syria, because in the run-up to his election as president, he was tweeting almost every week against Clinton, his opponent, saying that Obama should stay out of the Middle East, Obama shouldn't engage with Syria, we've got to put America first. In fact, one of his quotes said, we should stay the hell out of Syria. And there were numerous other tweets of that nature. When he gets into office, he actually does exactly the opposite within a few weeks. And he says that the reason he did it was that the beautiful babies, as he called them, who were gassed by Assad's attack on Khan Shaykhun, really upset him, and he felt that America had to do something. They didn't upset him enough to allow Syrian refugees into the country, and that's something that we will talk about a little bit later. I'll come back to that at the end of the introduction, because this is very, very important for us. But it did upset him enough to send in 58 Tomahawk cruise missiles onto an airport runway of a military base in the north of the country. Each one of the missiles, by the way, cost roughly £1 million. I think what you could do with £58 million to help refugees, or to help the people who had been genuinely suffering under Assad's dictatorship. So a lot of people have been speculating as to why this happened, and in some respects it's a bit daft to speculate, because nobody knows what's going on inside Trump's mind. Probably he doesn't even know entirely himself. But there are a few points that I think are worth pointing out. That inside the Trump administration, there is undoubtedly very serious tension between the extreme right-wing ideologues like Stephen Bannon and the guy he appointed originally for National Security Council, a guy called Flynn, who really do believe in American isolationism, American protectionism, cutting America off from the world, and who really do believe in the slogan America First, and they would presumably also say America First and Last. And there's been a lot of tension between them and, if you like, the old representatives of the corporate capitalist establishment, people like his son-in-law Kushner, but a whole host of others associated with the intelligence agencies and the military, the two key figures, McMaster and the other guy whose name, Mattis, the defense secretary, were both figures that Trump appointed somewhat reluctantly, because again, if you remember, during the run-up to his election, he was slagging off the defense establishment, and in particular slagging off the intelligence community, saying they were conspiring against him to get Hillary Clinton elected. Yet these two are now, it seems, determining what the policy is going to be. So that's one point. There is tension inside the Trump administration and the old style, if you like, American imperialists in the CIA and in the defense industry have worn out, and that's why he attacked Syria in the way he did. The other argument is that it's to deflect accusation, to deflect attention from the accusations that he was too close to Putin's Russia. Of course, Putin is one of Assad's biggest backers, biggest supporters, and therefore, by attacking Syria, he was putting Putin back in his box, if you like, and saying, all of these people who say I'm too soft on Putin, here's one for you, this proves I'm not. Again, it's funny, because again, before he was elected, every single week he was saying how wonderful Putin was, how much he admired him, how there would not be no conflict with Russia anymore. But he had so much criticism from the Democrats in particular. It's interesting, they didn't criticise him on other policies, but they did criticise him on his, inverted commas, closeness to Russia. So by the attack on Assad, it somehow puts their noses out of joint and convinces everybody that he's not soft on Putin After all, a good quote from a guy who wrote in The Nation magazine, he says, the object of Trump's Tomahawks, that's the cruise missiles, was not Syria's capacity to deploy gas. In other words, it's got nothing to do with Assad gassing his own citizens. He said, domestic liberal, but it was more likely because but domestic liberal opponents who base their resistance to Trump entirely on the premise that he's anti-American because he's too close to Putin and that he is a traitor to the bipartisan policy of humanitarian military interventionism. In other words, that the bipartisan policy adopted by Republicans and Democrats for as far back as the beginning of the Iraq War, and to be honest, before that, before 1990, the first Iraq War, has always been that when there is an international conflict, both the main parties in the United States speak with one voice and they support American military intervention, and that Trump was some kind of a traitor because he'd broken that convention. And he, by dropping the bombs, if you like, or sending in the missiles, was saying, no, on the contrary, I am showing everybody what a tough guy I am. At the same time that he fired the missiles off or gave the go-ahead for them to go off, he was on his golf course in Florida in a summit with the Chinese Prime Minister, Xi Jinping. And allegedly they were eating chocolate cake, and all of a sudden one of his generals said, oh, we're going to fire them off now, and he says to the Prime Minister of China, hang on a minute, I'm just going next door to authorise the sending off of these missiles. And again, it could be argued symbolically that this was an indication that America still is the world superpower, that China better watch out, because China's been in dispute with the United States over territories in the South China Sea. Also, China has been one of the countries, one of the principal countries, preventing any sanctions against North Korea. So again, you could argue that it was a symbolic gesture saying to the Chinese, just watch out. We're still around and we're still the biggest military power in the world, and actually we're also still the biggest economic power in the world. So that's possibility. That's a possibility as well. A very good article by Paul Mason in The Guardian a couple of days ago. It was good in parts, like the curious egg. It was in two columns. The first column was quite good. He says this was nothing more than symbolic. He said that he didn't think that this was the signal for Trump to go out in an all-out war against Assad in Syria, or for that matter, in confrontation with the Russians or the Chinese. He said that the Americans gave Russia 90 minutes notice that they were going to send the missiles in, and of course the Russians then gave Assad a little bit of notice. So all the troops on the airfield were got out, and the only people who were killed were 8 civilians. That gives you some indication of how geopolitical politics work. There is this collusion, this nod and a wink, and it's a symbolism that matters. And it's quite important for us to understand something that disappears off the agenda in recent years, because there's a lot of talk about Russian aggression, Russia flexing its muscles. There's a lot of talk about China being the coming power in the world, both economically and militarily. And what people forget, or has slipped their minds, if you like, is that America is still the biggest economic power in the world, and is by far the biggest military power. No matter how quickly China seems to be catching them up, America still is preeminent in both of those respects. And you could argue that this was a manifestation of Trump saying, this is who we are, and you better know your place. So there was a symbolic element within it. But I think in some ways, we can try to work out the rationale behind it, but in some ways it was more of a continuation of the existing establishment politics of Clinton and Obama, carrying it through into a new administration. And it's fascinating the way in which the liberal warmongers, all of those who supported the Gulf War, and all of those who support intervention in Syria, who call themselves in some instances socialists, but in many instances liberals or progressives, have been completely wrong-footed by this. They've been thrown into a state of tizzy. Not just Boris, the poodle, who had to cancel his visit to Russia because the Americans told him, you can't go and speak to the Russians because we are going to deal with them, not you. You just do what we're told. And of course, when the Americans tell the British Foreign Secretary what to do. You know, it's not whether he's going to jump or not. It's a question of how high he's going to jump. And Boris was made to look like the poodle that he is. Far more importantly, that the way in which it was the response to it came from figures who would regard themselves as being on the liberal left. The leader of the liberals in the European Parliament, a guy called Verhofstadt, completely supported the attack. Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, said it was a proportionate attack, completely supported it. And that was the day after Corbyn, quite rightly, had attacked Trump and said that this was an outrageous attack and we should be going to the UN and looking for peaceful means to resolve the problems in Syria. A bit of a platitude, if you like, but nevertheless he was clear about his opposition. The attack the next day, Watson defies him and supports the attack. Of course, the leader of the Liberals, you know, you would expect them to do a U-turn, and Farron again. By the way, in contravention of everything that Charles Kennedy did during the Iraq War, where the Liberals did take an anti-war position, he followed in Clegg's footsteps, the turncoat and the betrayer of all of their promises, and supported the Americans. More astonishingly, The Guardian, the paper, if you like, of by the way, the Washington Post, the New York Times, all of the media outlets in the States that supported Clinton and were hostile to Trump, every single one of them supported Trump's military attack. And The Guardian had an editorial supporting the attack. And Jonathan Friedland, who is their leading ideologue and leading, you know, opponent of left Labour, but who would pretend that he is, if you like, on the side of the angels in terms of progress throughout the world, said this was the right action. Unfortunately, it was committed by the wrong man. Now, there is a slight problem with that formulation, that it is contradictory. If it was the right action, somebody committed the action. So if it was the right action, the person who committed it was doing the right thing. The person who committed it was Trump. So you can't pretend to be opposed to Trump and at the same time support the action that he takes of this nature. And it'd be very interesting to see that all of those people who went on demonstrations saying they were standing up to Trump but were liberal progressives, now that he's taken action against Assad in Syria, how many of them would still come on a demonstration attacking Trump? I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what happens in a few months' time when we demonstrate against Trump. And there's a section of the left, further to the left, if you like, than The Guardian, who have taken an appalling position supporting the bombs. I mean, I mentioned Paul Mason's column. In the left-hand column, he makes some sensible columns about Trump's motivation. In the right-hand of part of the same article, he actually says that he supports the imposition of a no-fly zone in Syria, which would require military operations to defend the airspace and also military operations to attack Assad's military aircraft on the ground. There was another letter from explicit socialists in The Guardian saying that in order to support the Syrians who are under attack from Assad, the only thing we can do is to support military intervention against them, against Assad. And again, this is an argument that we have to confront. And I think we have to say that our opposition to any kind of imperialist intervention in conflicts throughout the world, we are opposed to, not in an abstract sense, but in a very principled way and in a very concrete way. And I think it's important to outline what the nature is of our concrete opposition. If you take the two most significant interventions in recent years, Iraq and Libya, it's interesting that the West is quite happy to support dictators in any country of the world if those dictators are doing their bidding. So the West supported Saddam Hussein in the war against Iran, a very bloody war in which millions on both sides were killed. The West supported Iran because he was seen to be standing up. The West supported Iraq and Saddam because he was seen to be standing up to the Iranians. When he got a little bit too big for his boots, they turned on him. And we had the first Iraq war and then subsequently the second Iraq war, which was bloody in the extreme, which led to massive anti-war protests throughout the world. But if you ask the question, what was the outcome of that intervention. What was the outcome of shock and awe, the American attack on Baghdad and the American occupation of Iraq, supported by Britain and British troops? What was the outcome, led of course by Tony Blair, the great warmonger himself? What was the outcome? Look at Iraq now. I wouldn't go so far as to describe Iraq as a basket case, because in some ways that's quite offensive to some of the Iraqi people who are having to try to survive and make lives out of the mess. But Iraq is divided in a whole number of different ways, not just along religious grounds between the Shiites and the Sunnis, but between each of those and the Kurds in the north. There is not any kind of stable government. There is continuing conflict there. And ironically, out of the occupation of Iraq by the Americans, because they released from prison in the Bagram Air Base all of the leaders of what has now become ISIS, America created or helped to create the circumstances in which, I'm not saying, it's a bit too crude to say America created the Islamic State. What you can definitely say is America and American imperialism created the circumstances in which those people released from prison who were part of that tradition were able to then mobilize and organize inside Iraq, first of all, and then subsequently in Syria, to pursue the objective of creating a caliphate and imposing the ISIS rule on the whole of that region. So the whole of Iraq now is a series of different conflicts and different battles. And even last week, you have the American intervention in Mosul. The Iraqi army, which is predominantly Shiite, is trying to drive ISIS out of Mosul. But there were, I should say, a million people in Mosul, a million civilians. In West Mosul, there were at least a quarter of a million people when the Americans bombed it last week. We don't know how many hundreds of civilians were killed. We do know that many of them were. So in an attempt to attack a new target in Iraq, they're creating an even bigger problem by massacring civilians in Mosul. And this is happening throughout the country. I haven't got time to go into every single area of conflict in Iraq, but suffice it to say, the intervention in Iraq has made a bad problem immeasurably worse and has made the situation for Iraqi people infinitely worse. And I think that we've got to be absolutely clear about that, and has also helped to create the main force that the Americans and the West are now saying they're fighting against the Islamic State. In Libya, if anything, the situation is worse. You have a situation in which the world hates Gaddafi. He is the pariah. All of a sudden, Tony Blair embraces him. He is the new friend of the West. Why? Because he claims to be against Islamic extremism. He has attacked Muslims and Islamists in the southern part of Libya. Libya is attacked, and instead of the West being able to shape the country it's attacked in its own image, you now have a situation in which Libya is divided into at least three separate sections now, with warring militias fighting each other, and with the Western-backed government absolutely powerless to intervene in any way, and with ISIS having gained a significant stronghold around the east of the country, where the main oil terminals are. So in fact, what has happened in Libya is to create a bloodbath, but also to divide the country in a very similar way to the way in which Iraq has been divided and fragmented. So it is not just that we say we are in principle against intervention, which we do, but we say what happens when you do intervene. And I've just given the two most recent examples, but of course we could give thousands of examples in the history of the 20th century where this kind of intervention has failed and made the situation worse for the countries that have been invaded. A couple of other things that I want to say before I finish. I think we have to say two things. How did the situation in Syria come to be as it is? And I haven't got time to go into all the details of why the Syrian uprising against Assad failed and has been followed by a counter-revolution. There's a lovely pamphlet by Anne Alexander and Jad Burahum called Syria Revo- uh, Revolution and Counter-Revolution and War, which we've got on the bookshelf, and I urge everybody to read that. But I'll just say it in a couple of sentences. In 2011, the Arab Spring started in Tunisia, spread to Egypt, Bahrain, and to Syria, mass revolts throughout Syria. Assad very cleverly launched a vicious offensive against the uprising and isolated it in key towns of the country. So he launched a massive attack on Homs, a city just north of Damascus, and then sealed the city off and did the same in a whole number of other urban areas which were the center of the revolt against his dictatorship. And that led to a situation in which the resistance became demoralized, and that led to a situation then which those Gulf countries that were supporting the uprising, ostensibly, fed into the conflict support for Islamic jihadists around ISIS and other groups associated with Al-Qaeda. And the resistance to Assad then became, instead of a popular uprising, it became much more closely associated with Islamic fundamentalism and with jihadis against the regime. So you have a situation now where the counter-revolution there is in the ascendancy, where Assad is doing his utmost to consolidate his position in the country with the support of Russia, and this is very, very important. But the country itself is, if you like, divided between those external forces that support it, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah, the militia from the Lebanon that has gone to fight on the side of Assad, and then against it, the Gulf states, and interestingly, the shifting alliances between Turkey and America, because Turkey and Russia on the one hand, Turkey is Russia's biggest enemy, but then Turkey discovers that in the course of the conflict, it has to address the question of the fact that the Kurds in the north of Syria, in the north of Syria, are doing a lot of the fighting against Islamic State and are gaining credibility and recognition, and therefore are posing threat to the Turkish state itself, because they're in alliance with the PKK, the Kurds in the east of the country, and now Turkey has turned on the Kurds more viciously than it was supporting the campaign against ISIS. So it's a very, very complicated set of alliances in the country, and they're always shifting and always changing. So the situation there is a terrible situation, there's no question about that. But what we can say unequivocally is that the intervention of the Americans and the intervention of any imperial power or sub-imperial power makes the situation worse. Last couple of points. I think it's really important that we answer the question when people say to us, well, what about Putin? All right, what the hell is going on with the Russians? And again, I think it's important to say, you know, in the old days when I first became a revolutionary and when I joined the International Socialists in 1972, I think it was, that we had a slogan, neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. And people say, oh yeah, that was all right then, because Russia was a real threat, you know, it invaded Czechoslovakia, and therefore you had to stand out against the Americans' intervention in Vietnam and the Russians' intervention in Czechoslovakia. Now Russia is no longer a threat, Russia is no longer an imperialist power. Actually, there is an element of truth in the fact that with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, Russia's imperial reach, if you like, has been very, very restricted, very limited. Its economy was depleted. It is in no way comparable to the United States in terms of its economic or political or military reach. Nevertheless, and this is something that's very important, that Putin wants to establish what I would call a sub-imperialist influence in key areas around, for example, the Ukraine, the Caucasus, and around the northern part of Syria, where it has bases and wants to establish itself, if you like, a kind of buffer zone between it and the NATO countries in a very limited way. So we have to say unequivocally, we are opposed to any imperialist intervention, whether it be American or whether it be Russian. And even though Russia is not the threat or doesn't have the power that it previously had, when it attempts to go beyond its borders to intervene in the conflicts in other countries, we equally say we're opposed to it. And it's very, very important that we don't let Putin off the hook And that we say that the Putin support for Assad is something that we are unequivocally against, just as we are against all forms of American and British imperialism. So I think that's very, very important. On a much more positive note, we've got very few comrades in Syria, and those who are still able to operate politically are immensely courageous and are still able to make political statements that are credible. And I just want to read a little bit of two sentences of a statement they made about Trump's bombing. They said it's a symbol of rivalry between imperialisms, and it's impossible to choose the lesser evils amongst these horrors. And I think we have to be absolutely clear that that is a succinct and very accurate way of describing it. When you have horrors perpetrated by both sides, we do not choose between the lesser of two horrors. We condemn them both. And then he goes on to say, we are against Assad, just in case they thought anybody thinks that they're just opposing American intervention. They are unequivocally against Assad and for his overthrow. They want to get rid of the Assad regime, quite rightly. Assad is a brutal dictator who's massacred his own people. But the crucial thing, but only at the hands of struggle by our own people. It is the responsibility and the, how shall I put it, ambition still of the Syrian people to overthrow their own dictator. And that is the position in which we stand. And the last point I want to make is this, and this is very, very important. I've been listening to stories in the last couple of days about how refugees have been welcomed into Chesterfield, and how that they have, Syrian refugees have been welcomed into Chesterfield, and how through solidarity with people here and support with people here, but also through the mechanisms of the UNHCR and all sorts of other agencies, despite the fragility of the whole situation, it is not beyond the wit of humanity, even in today's horrible imperialist world, a world of neoliberal, it is still not impossible to imagine how the refugees could be supported properly by the countries that were able to take them in. And the Chesterfield example, they're very small, three or four families have come here and been very well looked after. I mean, it's a drop in the ocean. But if you really want to help the suffering people in Syria, those millions who've been displaced to refugee camps in Lebanon and in Jordan, then open the borders in this country and in every other country that is able to take them in the West and welcome them. Trump has said quite explicitly they are banned from our country. And yet it would be, you know, the £58 million he spent on those missiles, if you spent £58 million on helping to deal with the issue of the Syrian refugees, then that would be going some way towards resolving the suffering that they are undergoing as a result of the conflict in Syria. And I think it's also important to end on this note, really, that when we say, say it loud, say it clear, refugees are welcome here, this is not an empty slogan. We actually mean it. And that we can actually resolve the situation for many of the refugees, at least in the short term. I'm not saying that this is what they would want indefinitely, but in the short term, countries like in the European Union and in America and Britain can actually resolve the question of the refugees, if only there was the will to do so, and if only they spent a fraction of the amount of money they spend on military operations in pursuing peace and in pursuing a sense of common humanity towards the millions who've been displaced by the war in Syria. That would be a tradition that we would be proud to associate ourselves with. So when we demonstrate politically in support of the refugees, we're not doing it in an abstract way just to say, well, we don't like the way they've been treated. We're saying, in practical terms, this problem could be resolved. In my own, borough of Hackney, the council has said it will take in 20 families. I mean, it's not much. I mean, even Theresa May said she would take in 20,000 families to Britain. How many have they taken in? Hardly any. In Hackney, not even the 20 have been taken in because the government won't fund the places for the refugees to come in and be properly supported. So it is possible to do it. So I want to contrast what could be done for the refugees with the crocodile tears that Trump is shedding about the poor children who have been gassed by Assad, saying that he felt sorry for them and that's why he sent the bombs off. If he really felt sorry for them, then he would be opening his borders and welcoming them into this country, as we and all of other European countries should be doing as well. Thank you.